Misery by Stephen King. Read by Lindsay Krauss. 1. Annie. When you look into the abyss also looks into you. Friedrich Nietzsche.
Number one. Number one. You're number one. Fion.
These sounds, even in the haze. But sometimes the sounds, like the pain, faded. And then there was only the haze. He remembered darkness. Solid darkness had come before the haze. Did that mean he was making progress? Let there be light, even of the hazy variety, and the light was good, and so on and so on. Had those sounds existed in the darkness? He didn't know the answers to any of these questions. Did it make sense to ask them? He didn't know the answer to that one either. The pain was somewhere below the sounds. The pain was east of the sun and south of his ears. That was all he did know. For some length of time that seemed very long, and so was, since the pain and the stormy haze were the only two things which existed, those sounds were the only outer reality. He had no idea who he was or where he was, and cared to know neither. He wished he was dead. But through the pain-soaked haze that filled his mind like a summer storm cloud, he did not know he wished it. As time passed, he became aware that there were periods of non-pain, and that these had a cyclic quality. And for the first time since emerging from the total blackness which had prologued the haze, he had a thought which existed apart from whatever his current situation was. This thought was of a broken-off piling which had jutted from the sand at Revere Beach. His mother and father had taken him to Revere Beach often when he was a kid, and he had always insisted that they spread their blanket where he could keep an eye on that piling, which looked to him like the single jutting fang of a buried monster. He liked to sit and watch the water come up until it covered the piling. Then hours later, after the sandwiches and potato salad had been eaten, after the last few drops of Kool-Aid had been coaxed from his father's big thermos, just before his mother said it was time to pack up and start home, the top of the rotted piling would begin to show again. Just a peak and a flash between the incoming waves at first, then more and more. By the time their trash was stashed in the big drum with Keep Your Beach Clean stenciled on the side, Polly's beach toys picked up. That's my name, Polly. I'm Polly. And tonight Ma put Johnson's baby oil on my sunburn, he thought inside the thunderhead where he now lived. And the blanket folded again. The piling had almost wholly reappeared, its blackish, slime-smooth sides surrounded by sudsy scuds of foam. It was the tide, his father had tried to explain, but he had always known it was the piling. The tide came and went, but the piling stayed. It was just that sometimes he couldn't see it. Without the piling, there was no tide. This memory circled and circled, maddening, like a sluggish fly. He groped for whatever it might mean, but for a long time the sounds interrupted.
Fion, red everything, number one.
Sometimes the sound stopped. Sometimes he stopped. His first really clear memory of this now, the now outside the storm haze, was of stopping. Of being suddenly aware he just couldn't pull another breath. And that was all right. That was good. That was, in fact, just peachy keen. He could take a certain level of pain, but enough was enough, and he was glad to be getting out of the game. Then there was a mouth clamped over his. A mouth which was unmistakably a woman's mouth, in spite of its hard, spitless lips. And the wind from this woman's mouth blew into his own mouth and down his throat, puffing his lungs. And when the lips were pulled back, he smelled his warder for the first time. Smelled her on the outrush of the breath she had forced into him, the way a man might force a part of himself into an unwilling woman. A dreadful mixed stench of vanilla cookies and chocolate ice cream and chicken gravy and peanut butter fudge. He heard a voice screaming, Breathe, goddammit! Breathe, Paul! The lips clamped down again. The breath blew down his throat again, blew down it like the dank suck of wind which follows a fast subway train, pulling sheets of newspaper and candy wrappers after it. And the lips were withdrawn. And he thought, for Christ's sake, don't let any of it out through your nose. But he couldn't help it. And oh, that stink, that stink, that fucking stink. Breathe, goddamn you! The unseen voice shrieked. And he thought, I will, anything, please, just don't do that anymore. Don't infect me anymore. And he tried. But before he could really get started, her lips were clamped over his again. Lips as dry and dead as strips of salted leather. And she raped him full of her air again. When she took her lips away this time, he did not let her breathe out, but pushed it, and whooped in a gigantic breath of his own, shoved it out, waited for his unseen chest to go up again on its own, as it had been doing his whole life without any help from him. When it didn't, he gave another giant whooping gasp, and then he was breathing again on his own, and doing it as fast as he could to flush the smell and taste of her out of him. Normal air had never tasted so fine. He began to fade back into the haze again, but before the dimming world was gone entirely, he heard the woman's voice mutter, "Phew, that was a close one." Not close enough, he thought, and fell asleep. He dreamed of the piling, so real he felt he could almost reach out and slide his palm over its green-black fissured curve. When he came back to his former state of semi-consciousness, he was able to make the connection between the piling and his current situation. It seemed to float into his hand. The pain wasn't tidal. That was the lesson of the dream, which was really a memory. The pain only appeared to come and go. The pain was like the piling, sometimes covered and sometimes visible, but always there. When the pain wasn't harrying him through the deep stone grayness of his cloud, he was dumbly grateful. But he was no longer fooled. It was still there, waiting to return. And there was not just one piling, but two. The pain was the pilings. And part of him knew for a long time before most of his mind had knowledge of knowing that the shattered pilings were his own shattered legs. But it was still a long time before he was finally able to break the dried scum of saliva that had glued his lips together and croak out, "Where am I?" to the woman who sat by his bed with a book in her hands. The name of the man who had written the book was Paul Sheldon. He recognized it as his own with no surprise. "Sidewinder, Colorado," she said when he was finally able to ask the question. "My name is Annie Wilkes, and I am..." "I know," he said. "You're my number one fan." "Yes," she said, smiling. "That's just what I am." Darkness. Then the pain and the haze. Then the awareness that although the pain was constant, it was sometimes buried by an uneasy compromise which he supposed was relief. The first real memory. Stopping. And being raped back into life by the woman's stinking breath. Next real memory. Her fingers pushing something into his mouth at regular intervals. Something like contact capsules. Only since there was no water, they only sat in his mouth. And when they melted, there was an incredibly bitter taste that was a little like the taste of aspirin. It would have been good to spit that bitter taste out, but he knew better than to do it. Because it was that bitter taste which brought the high tide in over the piling. Pilings. It's pilings. There are two, okay? There are two. Fine, now just hush. Just, you know, hush. And made it seem gone for a while. These things all came at widely spaced intervals, but then as the pain itself began not to recede but to erode, as that Revere Beach piling must itself have eroded, he thought, because nothing is forever, although the child he had been would have scoffed at such heresy. Outside, things began to impinge more rapidly until the objective world, with all its freight of memory, experience, and prejudice, had pretty much reestablished itself. He was Paul Sheldon, who wrote novels of two kinds, good ones and bestsellers. He had been married and divorced twice. He smoked too much, or had before all this, whatever all this was. Something very bad had happened to him, but he was still alive. That dark gray cloud began to dissipate faster and faster. It would be yet a while before his number one fan brought him the old clacking royal with a grinning gaped mouth and the ducky daddle's voice. But Paul understood long before then that he was in a hell of a jam. That prescient part of his mind saw her before he knew he was seeing her, and must surely have understood her before he knew he was understanding her. Why else did he associate such dour, ominous images with her? Whenever she came into the room, he thought of the graven images worshipped by superstitious African tribes in the novels of H. Rider Haggard, and stones, and doom. The image of Annie Wilkes as an African idol out of She or King Solomon's Mines was both ludicrous and queerly apt. She was a big woman, who, other than the large but unwelcoming swell of her bosom under the gray cardigan sweater she always wore, seemed to have no feminine curves at all. There was no defined roundness of hip or buttock, or even calf below the endless succession of wool skirts she wore in the house. She retired to her unseen bedroom to put on jeans before doing her outside chores. Her body was big, but not generous. There was a feeling about her of clots and roadblocks, rather than welcoming orifices or even open spaces, areas of hiatus. Most of all, she gave him a disturbing sense of solidity, as if she might not have any blood vessels or even internal organs, as if she might be only solid Annie Wilkes from side to side and top to bottom. He felt more and more convinced that her eyes, which appeared to move, were actually just painted on, and they move no more than the eyes of portraits which appear to follow you to wherever you move in the room where they hang. It seemed to him that if he made the first two fingers of his hand into a V and attempted to poke them up her nostrils, they might go less than an eighth of an inch before encountering a solid, if slightly yielding, obstruction. That even her gray cardigan and frumpy house skirts and faded outside work jeans were part of that solid, fibrous, unchanneled body. So his feeling that she was like an idol in a perfervid novel was not really surprising at all. Like an idol, she gave only one thing, a feeling of unease deepening steadily toward terror. Like an idol, she took everything else. No, wait. That wasn't quite fair. She did give something else. She gave him the pills that brought the tide in over the pilings. The pills were the tide. Annie Wilkes was the lunar presence which pulled them into his mouth like jetsam on a wave. She brought him two every 6 hours, first announcing her presence only as a pair of fingers poking into his mouth, and soon enough he learned to suck eagerly at those poking fingers in spite of the bitter taste. Later appearing in her cardigan sweater and one of her half-dozen skirts, usually with a paperback copy of one of his novels tucked under her arm. At night she appeared to him in a fuzzy pink robe, her face shiny with some sort of cream. He could have named the main ingredient easily enough, even though he had never seen the bottle from which she tipped it. The sheepy smell of lanolin was strong and proclamatory. Shaking him out of his frowsy, dream-thick sleep with the pills nestled in her hand and the poxy moon nestled in the window over one of her solid shoulders. After a while, after his alarm had become too great to be ignored, he was able to find out what she was feeding him. Was a painkiller with a heavy codeine base called Novril. The reason she had to bring him the bedpan so infrequently was not only because he was on a diet consisting entirely of liquids and gelatins. Earlier, when he was in the cloud, she had fed him intravenously, but also because Novril had a tendency to cause constipation in patients taking it. Another side effect, a rather more serious one, was respiratory depression in sensitive patients. Paul was not particularly sensitive, even though he had been a heavy smoker for nearly 18 years. But his breathing had stopped, nonetheless, on at least one occasion. There might have been others in the haze that he did not remember. That was the time she gave him his mouth-to-mouth. It might have been just one of those things which happened, but he later came to suspect she had nearly killed him with an accidental overdose. She didn't know as much about what she was doing as she believed she did. That was only one of the things about Annie that scared him. He discovered three things almost simultaneously, about 10 days after having emerged from the dark cloud. The first was that Annie Wilkes had a great deal of Novril. She had, in fact, a great many drugs of all kinds. The second was that he was hooked on Novril. The third was that Annie Wilkes was dangerously crazy. The darkness had prolonged the pain in the storm cloud. He began to remember what had prolonged the darkness as she told him what had happened to him. This was shortly after he had asked the traditional when the sleeper wakes question, and she had told him he was in the little town of Sidewinder, Colorado. In addition, she had told him that she had read each of his 8 novels at least twice, and had read her very favorites, the misery novels, 4, 5, maybe 6 times. She only wished he would write them faster. She said she had hardly been able to believe that her patient was really that Paul Sheldon, even after checking the ID in his wallet. "Where is my wallet, by the way?" he asked. "I've kept it safe for you," she said. Her smile suddenly collapsed into a narrow watchfulness he didn't like much. It was like discovering a deep crevasse, almost obscured by summer flowers in the midst of a smiling, jocund meadow. "Did you think I'd steal something out of it?" "No, of course not. It's just that the rest of my life is in it," he thought. "My life outside this room, outside the pain, outside the way time seems to stretch out like the long pink string of bubblegum a kid pulls out of his mouth when he's bored, because that's how it is in the last hour or so before the pills come." "Just what, Mr. Man?" she persisted. And he saw with alarm that the narrow look was growing blacker and blacker. The crevasse was spreading, as if an earthquake was going on behind her brow. He could hear the steady, keen whine of the wind outside, and he had a sudden image of her picking him up and throwing him over her solid shoulder, where he would lie like a burlap sack slung over a stone wall, and taking him outside and heaving him into a snowdrift. He would freeze to death. But before he did, his legs would throb and scream. "It's just that my father always told me to keep an eye on my wallet," he said, astonished by how easily this lie came out. His father had made a career out of not noticing Paul any more than he absolutely had to, and had, so far as Paul could remember, offered him only a single piece of advice in his entire life. On Paul's 14th birthday, his father had given him a Red Devil condom in a foil envelope. "Put that in your wallet," Roger Sheldon said. "And if you ever get excited while you're making out of the drive-in, take a second between excited enough to want to and too excited to care and slip that on. Too many bastards in the world already, and I don't want to see you go into the army at 16. Now Paul went on. "I guess he told me to keep my eye on my wallet so many times that it's stuck inside for good. If I offended you, I'm truly sorry." She relaxed. Smiled. The crevasse closed. Summer flowers nodded cheerfully once again. He thought of pushing his hand through that smile and encountering nothing but flexible darkness. "No offense taken. It's in a safe place. Wait. I've got something for you." She left and returned with a steaming bowl of soup. There were vegetables floating in it. He was not able to eat much, but he ate more than he thought at first he could. She seemed pleased. It was while he ate the soup that she told him what had happened, and he remembered it all as she had told him, and he supposed it was good to know how you happened to end up with your legs shattered. But the manner by which he was coming to this knowledge was disquieting. It was as if he was a character in a story or a play, a character whose history is not recounted like history, but created like fiction. She had gone into Sidewinder in the 4-wheel drive to get feed for the livestock and a few groceries. Also to check out the paperbacks at Wilson's Drug Center. That had been the Wednesday that was almost 2 weeks ago now, and the new paperbacks always came in on Tuesday. "I was actually thinking of you," she said, spooning soup into his mouth, and then professionally wiping away a dribble from the corner with a napkin. "That's what makes it such a remarkable coincidence, do you see? I was hoping Misery's Child would finally be out in paperback, but no such luck." A storm had been on the way, she said, but until noon that day the weather forecasters had been confidently claiming it would veer south, toward New Mexico and the Sangre de Cristos. "Yes," he said, remembering as he said it. "They said it would turn. That's why I went in the first place." He tried to shift his legs. The result was an awful bolt of pain, and he groaned. "Don't do that," she said. If you get those legs of yours talking, Paul, they won't shut up. And I can't give you any more pills for 2 hours. I'm giving you too much as it is. Why aren't I in the hospital? This was clearly the question that wanted asking, but he wasn't sure it was a question either of them wanted asked. Not yet, anyway. When I got to the feed store, Tony Roberts told me I better step on it if I was going to get back here before the storm hit, and I said, "How far are we from this town?" he asked. "A ways," she said vaguely, looking off toward the window. There was a queer interval of silence, and Paul was frightened by what he saw in her face, because what he saw was nothing. The black nothing of a crevasse folded into an alpine meadow, a blackness where no flowers grew and into which the drop might be long. It was the face of a woman who has come momentarily untethered from all of the vital positions and landmarks of her life. A woman who has forgotten not only the memory she was in the process of recounting, but memory itself. He had once toured a mental asylum. This was years ago, when he had been researching Misery, the first of the 4 books which had been his main source of income over the last 8 years. And he had seen this look, or more precisely, this unlook. The word which defined it was catatonia. But what frightened him had no such precise word. It was, rather, a vague comparison. In that moment he thought that her thoughts had become much as he had imagined her physical self. Solid, fibrous, unchanneled, with no place of hiatus. Then slowly her face cleared. Thoughts seemed to flow back into it. Then he realized flowing was just a tiny bit wrong. She wasn't filling up like a pond or a tidal pool. She was warming up. Yes, she is warming up like some small electrical gadget. A toaster, maybe a heating pad. I said to Tony, "A storm is going south." She spoke slowly at first, almost groggily, but then her words began to catch up to normal cadence and to fill with normal conversational brightness. But now he was alerted. Everything she said was a little strange, a little offbeat. Listening to Annie was like listening to a song played in the wrong key. But he said, "It changed its mind." "Oh, poop," I said. "I'd better get on my horse and ride." "I'd stay in town if you can, Miss Wilkes," he said. "Now they're saying on the radio that it's going to be a proper geezer and nobody's prepared. But of course I had to get back. There's no one to feed the animals but me. The nearest people are the Roidmans, and they're miles from here. Besides, the Roidmans don't like me." She cast an eye shrewdly on him as she said this last, and when he didn't reply, she tapped the spoon against the rim of the bowl in peremptory fashion. "Done?" "Yes, I'm full, thanks. It was very good. Do you have a lot of livestock?" Because, he was already thinking, if you do, that means you've got to have some help. A hired man, at least. Help was the operant word. Already that seemed like the operant word, and he had seen she wore no wedding ring. "Not very much," she said. "Half a dozen laying hens, 2 cows, and Misery." He blinked. She laughed. "You won't think I'm very nice, naming a sow after the brave and beautiful woman you made up. But that's her name, and I meant no disrespect." After a moment's thought, she added, "She's very friendly." The woman wrinkled up her nose and for a moment became a sow, even down to the few bristly whiskers that grew on her chin. She made a pig sound. Paul looked at her wide-eyed. She did not notice. She had gone away again, her gaze dim and musing. Her eyes held no reflection but the lamp on the bed-table, twice reflected, dwelling faintly in each. At last she gave a faint start and said, "I got about 5 miles, and then the snow started. It came fast. Once it starts up here, it always does. I came creeping along with my lights on, and then I saw your car off the road, overturned." She looked at him disapprovingly. "You didn't have your lights on." "It took me by surprise," he said, remembering only at that moment how he'd been taken by surprise. He did not yet remember that he had also been quite drunk. "I stopped," she said. "If it had been on an upgrade, I might not have. Not very Christian, I know, but there were 3 inches on the road already. And even with a four-wheel drive, you can't be sure of getting going again once you lose your forward motion. It's easier just to say to yourself, oh, they probably got out, caught a ride, etc., etc. But it was on top of the third big hill past the Roydmans, and it's flat there for a while. So I pulled over, and as soon as I got out, I heard groaning. That was you, Paul. She gave him a strange maternal grin. For the first time, clearly, the thought surfaced in Paul Sheldon's mind. I am in trouble here. This woman is not right. She sat beside him where he lay in what might have been a spare bedroom for the next 20 minutes or so and talked. As his body used the soup, the pain in his legs reawakened. He willed himself to concentrate on what she was saying, but she was not entirely able to succeed. His mind had bifurcated. On one side, he was listening to her tell how she had dragged him from the wreckage of his 74 Camaro. That was the side where the pain throbbed and ached like a couple of old splintered pilings beginning to wink and flash between the heaves of the withdrawing tide. On the other, he could see himself at the Boulderado Hotel, finishing his new novel, which did not, thank God for small favors, feature Misery Chastain. There were all sorts of reasons for him not to write about misery, but one loomed above the rest, ironclad and unshakable. Misery, thank God for large favors, was finally dead. She had died 5 pages from the end of Misery's Child. Not a dry eye on the house when that happened, including Paul's own. Only the dew falling from his ocularies had been the result of hysterical laughter. Finishing the new book, a contemporary novel about a car thief, he had remembered typing the final sentence of Misery's Child. So Ian and Jeffrey left the little Dunthorpe churchyard together, supporting themselves in their sorrow, determined to find their lives again. While writing this line, he had been giggling so madly it had been hard to strike the correct keys. He had to go back several times. Thank God for good old IBM correct tape. He had written the end below and then had gone capering about the room, the same room in the Boulderado Hotel, and screaming, "Free at last! Free at last! Great God Almighty, I'm free at last! The silly bitch finally bought the farm." The new novel was called Fast Cars, and he hadn't laughed when it was done. He just sat there in front of the typewriter for a moment, thinking, "You may have just won next year's American Book Award, my friend." And then he had picked up. A little bruise on your right temple, but that didn't look like anything. It was your leg. I could see right away, even with the light starting to fade, that your legs weren't... The telephone and called room service for a bottle of Dom Perignon. He remembered waiting for it to come, walking back and forth in the room where he had finished all of his books since 1974. He remembered tipping the waiter with a $50 bill and asking him if he had heard a weather forecast. He remembered the pleased, flustered, grinning waiter telling him that the storm currently heading their way was supposed to slide off to the south, toward New Mexico. He remembered the chill feel of the bottle, the discreet sound of the cork as he eased it free. He remembered the dry, acerbic, acidic taste of the first glass. And opening his travel bag and looking at his plane ticket to New York, he remembered suddenly, on the spur of the moment, deciding that I better get you home right away. It was a struggle getting into the truck, and I'm a big woman, as you may have noticed, and I had a pile of blankets in the back. I got you in and wrapped you up, and even then, with the light fading and all, I thought you looked familiar. I thought maybe he would just get the old Camaro out of the parking garage and just drive west instead of getting on the plane. What the hell was there in New York anyway? The townhouse, empty, bleak, unwelcoming, possibly burgled. Screw it, he thought, drinking more champagne. Go west, young man, go west. The idea had been crazy enough to make sense. Take nothing but a change of clothes and his bag I found. I put that in too, but there wasn't anything else I could see, and I was scared you might die on me or something, so I fired up old Bessie and I got your manuscript of Fast Cars and hit the road to Vegas or Reno, or maybe even the City of Angels. He remembered the idea had also seemed a bit silly at first. A trip the kid of 24 he had been when he sold his first novel might have taken, but not one for a man 2 years past his 40th birthday. A few more glasses of champagne, and the idea no longer seemed silly at all. It seemed, in fact, almost noble. A kind of grand odyssey to somewhere. A way to reacquaint himself with reality after the fictional terrain of the novel. So he had gone. Out like a light. I was sure you were going to die. I mean, I was sure. So I slipped your wallet out of your back pocket and I looked at your driver's license and I saw the name Paul Sheldon. And I thought, oh, that must be a coincidence. But the picture on the license also looked like you. And I got so scared I had to sit down at the kitchen table. I thought at first I was going to faint. After a while, I started thinking maybe the picture was just a coincidence, too. Those driver's license photos really don't look like anybody. But then I found your Writers Guild card and one from Penn, and I knew you were in trouble when the snow started coming down. But long before that, he had stopped in the Boulderado bar and tipped George $20 to provide him with a second bottle of Dom. And he had drunk it rolling up I-70 into the Rockies under a sky the color of gunmetal. And somewhere east of the Eisenhower Tunnel, he had diverted from the turnpike because the roads were bare and dry. The storm was sliding off to the south. What the hay? And also the goddamn tunnel made him nervous. He had been playing an old Bo Diddley tape on the cassette machine under the dash. Never turned on the radio until the Camaro started to seriously slip and slide. And he began to realize that this wasn't just a passing upcountry flurry, but the real thing. The storm was maybe not sliding off to the south after all. The storm was maybe coming right at him, and he was maybe in a bucket of trouble. The way you're in trouble now. But he had been just drunk enough to think he could drive his way out of it. So instead of stopping in Cana and inquiring about shelter, he had driven on. He could remember the afternoon turning into a dull gray chromium lens. He could remember the champagne beginning to wear off. He could remember leaning forward to get his cigarettes off the dashboard. That was when the last skid began, and he tried to ride it out, but it kept getting worse. He could remember a heavy, dull thump, and then the worlds up and down had swapped places. He had screamed! A stream of muddy-colored beef soup fell on the coverlet. She looked at it, then at him, and her face twisted.
There! Look what you made me do!
I'm sorry.
Sure you are!
She screamed and threw the bowl into the corner where it shattered. Soup splashed up the wall. He gasped. She turned off then. She just sat there for what might have been 30 seconds. During that time, Paul Sheldon's heart did not seem to beat at all. She roused a little at a time, and suddenly she tittered.
I have such a temper, she said.
I'm sorry, he said, out of a dry throat.
You should be.
Her face went slack again, and she looked moodily at the wall. He thought she was going to blank out again, but instead she fetched a sigh and lifted her bulk from the bed.
You don't have any need to use such words in the misery books, because they didn't use such words at all back then. They weren't even invented. Animal times demand animal words, I suppose, but that was a better time. You ought to stick to your misery stories, Paul. I say that sincerely, as your number one fan.
She went to the door and looked back at him.
I'll put that manuscript book back in your bag and finish Misery's Child. I may go back to the other one later when I'm done.
Don't do that if it makes you mad, he said. He tried to smile.
I'd rather not have you mad. I sort of depend on you, you know.
She did not return his smile.
Yes, she said. You do. You do, don't you, Paul?
She left. The tide went out. The pilings were back. He began to wait for the clock to chime. Two chimes. The chimes came. He lay propped up on the pillows, watching the door. She came in. She was wearing an apron over her cardigan and one of her skirts. In one hand, she held a floor bucket.
I suppose you want your cock-a-doodle medication, she said.
Yes, please. He tried to smile at her ingratiatingly, and felt that shame again. He felt grotesque to himself, a stranger.
I have it, she said. But first I have to clean up the mess in the corner. The mess you made. You have to wait until I do that.
He lay in the bed with his legs making shapes like broken branches under the coverlet, and cold sweat running down his face in little slow creaks. He lay and watched as she crossed to the corner and set the bucket down, and then picked up the pieces of the bowl and took them out, and came back and knelt by the bucket and fished in it, and brought out a soapy rag and wrung it out, and began to wash the dried soup from the wall. He lay and watched, and at last he began to shiver, and the shivering made the pain worse, but he could not help it. Once she turned around and saw him shivering and soaking the bedclothes in sweat, and she favored him with such a sly, knowing smile that he could easily have killed her.
"It's dried on," she said, turning her face back into the corner. "I'm afraid this is going to take a while, Paul."
She scrubbed. The stain slowly disappeared from the plaster, but she went on dipping the cloth, wringing it out, scrubbing, and then repeating the whole process. He could not see her face, but the idea, the certainty, that she had gone blank and might go on scrubbing the wall for hours, tormented him. At last, just before the clock chimed once, marking 2:30, she got up and dropped the rag into the water. She took the bucket from the room without a word. He lay in bed listening to the creaking boards which marked her heavy, stolid passage, listening as she poured the water out of her bucket, and incredibly the sound of the faucet as she drew more. He began to cry soundlessly. The tide had never gone out so far. He could see nothing but drying mud flats and those splintered pilings which cast their eternal damaged shadows. She came back and stood for just a moment inside the doorway, observing his wet face with that same mixture of sternness and maternal love. Then her eyes drifted to the corner where no sign of the splashed soup remained.
"Now I must rinse," she said, "or else the soap will leave a dull spot. I must do it all. I must make everything right. Living alone, as I do, is no excuse whatever for scamping the job. My mother had a motto, Paul and I live by it. Once nasty, never neat," she used to say.
"Please," he groaned. "Please, the pain, I'm dying."
"No, you're not dying. I'll scream," he said, beginning to cry harder. It hurt to cry. It hurt his legs and it hurt his heart. "I won't be able to help it." "Then scream," she said. "But remember that you made that mess, not me. It's nobody's fault but your own."
Somehow he was able to keep from screaming. He watched as she dipped and wrung and rinsed, dipped and wrung and rinsed. At last, just as the clock in what he assumed was the parlor began to strike three, she rose and picked up the bucket. "She's going to go out and I'll hear her pouring the rinse water down the sink, and maybe she won't come back for hours, because maybe she's not done punishing me yet." But instead of leaving, she walked over to the bed and fished in her apron pocket. She brought out not two capsules, but three.
"Here," she said tenderly. He gobbled them into his mouth, and when he looked up, he saw her lifting the yellow plastic floor bucket toward him.
It filled his field of vision like a falling moon. Grayish water slopped over the rim onto the coverlet.
"Wash them down with this," she said.
Her voice was still tender. He stared at her, and his face was all eyes.
"Do it," she said. "I know you can dry swallow them. Please believe me when I say I can make them come right back up again. After all, it's only rinse water. Won't hurt you."
She leaned over him like a monolith, the bucket slightly tipped. He could see the rag twisting slowly in its dark depths like a drowned thing. He could see a thin scum of soap on top. Part of him groaned, but none of him hesitated. He drank quickly, washing the pills down, and the taste in his mouth was as it had been on the occasions when his mother made him brush his teeth with soap. His belly hitched, and he made a thick sound.
"I wouldn't throw them up, Paul. No more until 9 tonight."
She looked at him for a moment with a flat, empty gaze, and then her face lit up and she smiled.
"You won't make me mad again, will you?"
"No," he whispered. "Anger the moon which brought the tide. What an idea. What a bad idea."
"I love you," she said. and kissed him on the cheek. She left, not looking back, carrying the floor bucket the way a sturdy countrywoman might carry a milk pail, slightly away from her body with no thought at all, so that none would spill. He lay back, tasting grit and plaster in his mouth and throat, tasting soap. I won't throw up. Won't throw up. Won't throw up. At last, the urgency of this thought began to fade, and he realized he was going to sleep. He had held everything down long enough for the medication to begin its work. He had won. This time. He dreamed he was being eaten by a bird. It was not a good dream. There was a bang, and he thought, yes, good, all right, shoot it. Shoot the goddamn thing. Then he was awake, knowing it was only Annie Wilkes pulling the back door shut. She had gone out to do the chores. He heard the dim crunch of her footsteps in the snow. She went past his window, wearing a parka with a hood up. Her breath plumed out, then broke apart on her moving face. She didn't look in at him, intent on her chores in the barn, he supposed. Feeding the animals, cleaning the stalls, maybe casting a few runes, he wouldn't put it past her. The sky was darkening purple. Sunset. 5:30, maybe 6 o'clock. The tide was still in, and he could have gone back to sleep, wanted to go back to sleep. But he had to think about this bizarre situation while he was still capable of something like rational thought. The worst thing he was discovering was that he didn't want to think about it even if he could. Even when he knew he could not bring the situation to an end without thinking about it. His mind kept trying to push it away. Like a child pushing away his meal even though he had been told he cannot leave the table until he's eaten it. He didn't want to think about it because just living it was hard enough. He didn't want to think about it because whenever he did, unpleasant images intervened. The way she went blank. The way she made him think of idols and stones. And now the way the yellow plastic floor bucket had sped toward his face like a crashing moon. Thinking of those things would not change his situation. Was in fact worse than not thinking at all. But once he turned his mind to Annie Wilkes and his chin here in her house, they were the thoughts that came, crowding out all others. His heart would start to beat too fast, mostly in fear, but partly in shame, too. He saw himself putting his lips to the rim of the yellow floor bucket, saw the rinse water with its film of soap and the rag floating in it, saw these things but drank anyway, never hesitating a bit. He would never tell anyone about that, assuming he ever got out of this, and he supposed he might try to lie about it to himself, but he would never be able to do it. Yet miserable or not, and he was, he still wanted to live. Think about it, goddammit. Jesus Christ, are you already so cowed you can't even try? No, but almost that cowed. Then an odd, angry thought occurred to him. She doesn't like the new book because she's too stupid to understand what it's up to. The thought wasn't just odd. Under the circumstances, how she felt about fast cars was totally immaterial. But thinking about the things she had said was at least a new avenue, and feeling angry at her was better than feeling scared of her. And so he went down it with some eagerness. Too stupid? No. Too set. Not just unwilling to change, but antagonistic to the very idea of change. Yes. And while she might be crazy, was she so different in her evaluation of his work from the hundreds of thousands of other people across the country? 90% of them women, who could barely wait for each new 500-page episode in the turbulent life of the foundling who had risen to marry a peer of the realm? No, not at all. They wanted misery, misery, misery. Each time he had taken a year or two off to write one of the other novels, what he thought of as his serious work, with what was at first certainty and then hope, and finally a species of grim determination, he had received a flood of protesting letters from these women, many of whom signed themselves "Your Number One Fan." The tone of these letters varied from bewilderment, that always hurt the most somehow, to reproach, to outright anger. But the message was always the same. It wasn't what I expected. It wasn't what I wanted. Please go back to misery. I want to know what misery is doing. He could write a modern Under the Volcano, Tess of the D'Urberville, The Sound and Fury. It wouldn't matter. They still wanted misery, misery, misery. It's hard to follow. He's not interesting. And the profanity. The anger sparked again. Anger at her obdurate density. Anger that she could actually kidnap him, keep him prisoner here, force him into a choice between drinking dirty rinse water from a floor bucket or suffering the pain of his shattered legs. And then on top of all that, find the nerve to criticize the best thing he had ever written. "Bugger you and the F-word you wrote in on," he said. And he suddenly felt better again. Felt himself again. And even though he knew this rebellion was petty and pitiful and meaningless, she was in the barn where she couldn't hear him, and the tide was safely in over the splintered pilings. Still, he remembered her coming in here, withholding the capsules, coercing permission to read the manuscript of Fast Cars. He felt a flush of shame and humiliation warming his face, but now they were mixed with real anger. It had bloomed from a spark into a tiny, sunken flame. He had never shown anyone a manuscript before he had proofread it and then retyped it. Never. Not even Bryce, his agent. Never. Why, he didn't even... For a moment, his thoughts broke off cleanly. He could hear the dim sound of a cow mooing. Why, he didn't even make a copy until the second draft was done. The manuscript copy of Fast Cars, which was now in Annie Wilkes' possession, was in fact the only existing copy in the whole world. He had even burned his notes. 2 years of hard work. She didn't like it, and she was crazy. Misery was what she liked. Misery was who she liked. Not some foul-talking little spick Carthy from Spanish Harlem. He remembered thinking, "Turn the pages of the manuscript into paper hats if you want. Just please." The anger and humiliation surged again, awakening the first dull answering throb in his legs. Yes, the work. The pride in your work. The worth of the work itself. All those things faded away to the magic lantern shades they really were when the pain got bad enough. That she would do that to him, that she could, when he had spent most of his adult life thinking the word writer was the most important definition of himself, made her seem utterly monstrous, something he must escape. She really was an idol, and if she didn't kill him, she might kill what was in him. Now he heard the eager squeal of a pig. She had thought he would mind, but he thought Misery was a wonderful name for a pig. He remembered how she had imitated it, the way her upper lip had wrinkled toward her nose, how her cheeks had seemed to flatten, how she had actually looked like a pig for a moment. From the barn, her voice, "Suey, pig, pig, pig!" He lay back, put his arm over his eyes, and tried to hold on to the anger. Because the anger made him feel brave. A brave man could think. A coward couldn't. Here was a woman who had been a nurse, he was sure of that. Was she still a nurse? No, because she did not go to work. Why did she no longer practice her trade? That seemed obvious. Not all her gear was stowed right. Lots of it was rolling around in the holds. If it was obvious to him, even through the haze of pain he'd been living in, it would surely have been obvious to her colleagues. And he had a little extra information on which to judge just how much of her gear wasn't stowed right, didn't he? She had dragged him from the wreck of his car, and instead of calling the police or an ambulance, she had installed him in her guest room, put IV drips in his arms, and a shitload of dope in his body. Enough so he had gone into what she called respiratory depression at least once. She had told no one he was here, and if she hadn't by now, that meant she didn't mean to. Would she have behaved in this same fashion if it had been Joe Blow from Kokomo she had hauled out of the wreck? No. No, he didn't think so. She had kept him, because he was Paul Sheldon. And she's my number one fan, Paul muttered, and put an arm over his eyes. An awful memory bloomed there in the dark. His mother had taken him to the Boston Zoo, and he'd been looking at a great big bird. It had the most beautiful feathers, red and purple and royal blue that he had ever seen, and the saddest eyes. He had asked his mother where the bird had come from, and when she said Africa, he had understood it was doomed to die in the cage where it lived, far away from wherever God had meant it to be. And he cried, and his mother brought him an ice cream cone, and for a while he had stopped crying, and then he remembered and started again, and so she had taken him home, telling him as they rode the trolley back to Lynn that he was a ball baby and a sissy. Its feathers. Its eyes. The throbbing in his legs began to cycle up. No, no, no. He pressed the crook of his elbow more tightly against his eyes. From the barn he could hear spaced thudding noises. Impossible to tell what they were, of course, but in his imagination. Your mind, your creativity. That is all I meant. He could see her pushing bales of hay out of the loft with the heel of her boot. Could see them tumbling to the barn floor. Africa. That bird came from Africa, from... Then cutting cleanly through this like a sharp knife, came her agitated, almost screaming voice.
Do you think that when they put me up there on the stand and Den...
Up on the stand. When they put me up on the stand in Denver. Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth, so help you God? I don't know where he gets it. I do. He's always writing things like this down. State your name. Nobody on my side of the family had an imagination like his.
Annie Wilkes.
So vivid.
My name is Annie Wilkes.
He willed her to say more. She would not. Come on, he muttered, his arm over his eyes. This was the way he thought best, the way he imagined best. His mother liked to tell Mrs. Mulvaney on the other side of the fence what a marvelous imagination he had, so vivid, and what wonderful little stories he was always writing down. Except, of course, when she was calling him a sissy and a ball baby. Come on, come on, come on. He could see the courtroom in Denver. Could see Annie Wilkes on the stand. Not wearing jeans now, but a rusty purple-black dress and an awful hat. He could see that the courtroom was crowded with spectators, and the judge was bald and wearing glasses. The judge had a white mustache. There was a birthmark beneath the white mustache. The white mustache covered most of it, but not quite all.
Annie Wilkes.
He read it. Just three. Can you imagine?
That spirit of fan love.
He's always writing things down, making things up.
Now I must rinse.
Africa. That bird came from...
Come on,
he whispered, but could get no further. The bailiff asked her to state her name, and over again she said it was Annie Wilkes, but she said no more. She sat there with her fibrous, solid, ominous body displacing air, and said her name over and over again, but no more than that. Still trying to imagine why the ex-nurse who had taken him prisoner might have once been put on the stand in Denver, Paul drifted off to sleep. He was in a hospital ward. Great relief swept through him. So great he felt like crying. Something had happened when he was asleep. Something had come, or perhaps Annie had a change of heart or mind. It didn't matter. He had gone to sleep in the monster woman's house and had awakened in the hospital. But surely they would not have put him in a long ward like this. It was as big as an airplane hangar. Identical rows of men with identical bottles of nutrient hung from identical IV trays beside their beds filled the place. He sat up and saw that the men themselves were also identical. They were all him. Then distantly he heard the clock chime and understood that it was chiming from beyond the wall of sleep. This was a dream. Sadness replaced the relief. The door at the far end of the huge ward opened, and in came Annie Wilkes. Only she was dressed in a long apron dress, and there was a mob cap on her head. She was dressed as Misery Chastain in Misery's Love. Over one arm she held a wicker basket. There was a towel over the contents. She folded the towel back as he watched. She reached in and took out a handful of something and flung it into the face of the first sleeping Paul Sheldon. It was sand, he saw. This was Annie Wilkes pretending to be Misery Chastain, pretending to be the Sandman. Sandwoman. Then he saw that the first Paul Sheldon's face had turned a ghastly white as soon as the sand struck it, and fear jerked him out of the dream and into the bedroom where Annie Wilkes was standing over him. She was holding the fat paperback of Misery's Child in one hand. Her bookmark suggested she was about 3/4 of the way through. "You were moaning," she said. "I had a bad dream." "What was it about?" The first thing which was not the truth that popped into his head was what he replied. "Africa." She came in late the following morning, her face the color of ashes. He had been dozing, but he came awake at once, jerking up on his elbows. "Miss Wilkes? Annie? Are you all right?"
"No."
"Christ, she's had a heart attack," he thought. And there was a moment's alarm, which was immediately replaced by joy. "Let her have one. A big one. A fucking chest buster." He would be more than happy to crawl to the telephone, no matter how much it might hurt. He would crawl to the telephone over broken glass, if that was what it took. And it was a heart attack, but not the right kind. She came toward him, not quite staggering, but rolling, the way a sailor will when he's just gotten off his ship at the end of a long voyage.
"What?"
He tried to shrink away from her, but there was no place to go. There was only the headboard, and behind that, the wall.
"No!"
She reached the side of the bed, bumped it, wavered, and for a moment seemed on the verge of falling on top of him. Then she just stood there, looking down at him out of her paper-white face, the cords on her neck standing out, one vein pulsing in the center of her forehead. Her hands snapped open, hooked shut into solid rock-like fists, then snapped open again.
"You! You! You dirty bird!"
"What? I don't..." But suddenly he did, and his entire midsection first seemed to turn hollow and then to entirely disappear. He remembered where her bookmark had been last night, 3/4 of the way through. She had finished it. She knew all there was to know. She knew that Misery hadn't been the barren one after all. It had been Ian. Had she sat there in her as-yet-unseen-by-him parlor, with her mouth open and her eyes wide, as Misery finally realized the truth and made her decision and sneaked off to Jeffrey? Had her eyes filled with tears when she realized that Misery and Jeffrey, far from having a clandestine affair behind the back of the man they both loved, were giving him the greatest gift they could, a child he would believe to be his own? And had her heart risen up when Misery told Ian she was pregnant, and Ian had crushed her to him, tears flowing from his eyes, muttering, "My dear, oh my dear," over and over again? He was sure in those few seconds that all of those things had happened. But instead of weeping with exalted grief, as she should have done when Misery expired, giving birth to the boy whom Ian and Jeffrey would presumably raise together, she was mad as hell.
"She can't be dead!"
Annie Wilkes shrieked at him. Her hand snapped open and hooked closed in a faster and faster rhythm.
"Misery Chastain cannot be dead!"
"Annie, Annie, please." There was a glass water pitcher on the table. She seized it up and brandished it at him. Cold water splashed his face. An ice cube landed behind his left ear and slid down the pillow into the hollow of his shoulder. In his mind, so vivid, he saw her bringing the pitcher down into his face. He saw himself dying of a fractured skull and a massive cerebral hemorrhage in a freezing flood of ice water while goose pimples formed on his arms. She wanted to do it. There was no question of that. At the very last moment, she pivoted away from him and flung the water pitcher at the door instead, where it shattered as the soup bowl had the other day. She looked back at him and brushed her hair away from her face. Two hard little spots of red had now bloomed in the white, with the backs of her hands.
"Dirty bird," she panted. "Oh, you dirty birdie, how could you?"
He spoke rapidly, urgently, eyes flashing, riveted on her face. He was positive in that moment that his life might depend on what he was able to say in the next 20 seconds. Annie. In 1871, women frequently died in childbirth. Misery gave her life for her husband and her best friend and her child. The spirit of misery will always...
I don't want her spirit!
She screamed, hooking her fingers into claws and shaking them at him as if she would tear his eyes out.
I want her! You killed her! You murdered her!
Her hands snapped shut into fists again, and she drove them down like pistons, one on either side of his head. They punched deep into the pillow, and he bounced like a rag doll. His legs flared, and he cried out.
I didn't kill her!
He screamed. She froze, staring at him with that narrow black expression, that look of crevasse.
Of course not,
she said, bitterly sarcastic.
And if you didn't, Paul Sheldon, who did it?
No one, he said more quietly. She just died. Ultimately, he knew this to be the truth. If Misery Chastain had been a real person, he knew he might very well have been called upon to aid the police in their inquiries, as the euphemism went. After all, he had a motive. He had hated her. Ever since the third book, he had hated her. For April Fool's Day, 4 years ago, he'd had a small booklet privately printed, and had sent it to a dozen close acquaintances. It had been called Misery's Hobby. In it, Misery spent a cheerful country weekend boffing Growler, Ian's Irish setter. He might have murdered her, but he hadn't. In the end, in spite of his having grown to despise her, Misery's death had been something of a surprise to him. He had remained true enough to himself for art to imitate life, however feebly, to the very end of Misery's hackneyed adventures. She had died a most unexpected death. His cheerful capering had in no way changed the fact.
You lie, Annie whispered. I thought you were good, but you are not good. You are just a lying old dirty birdie.
She slipped away, that's all. Sometimes that happens. It was like life when someone just... She overturned the table by the bed. The one shallow drawer spilled out. His wristwatch and pocket change spilled out with it. He hadn't even known they were there. He cringed back from her.
You must think I was born yesterday, she said.
Her lips drew back from her teeth.
In my job, I saw dozens of people die. Hundreds, now that I think about it. Sometimes they go screaming, and sometimes they go in their sleep. They just slip away, the way you said, sure. But characters in stories do not just slip away. God takes us when he thinks it's time, and a writer is God to the people in a story. He made them up just like God made us up. And no one can get a hold of God to make him explain, all right, okay. But as far as Misery goes, I'll tell you one thing, you dirty bird. I'll tell you that God just happens to have a couple of broken legs. And God just happens to be in my house, eating my food and...
She went blank then. She straightened up with her hands hanging limply by her sides, looking at the wall where an old photograph of the Arc de Triomphe was hung. She stood there, and Paul lay in his bed with round marks in the pillow beside his ears and looked at her. He could hear the water which had been in the pitcher dripping on the floor, and it came to him that he could commit murder. This was a question which had occurred to him from time to time, strictly academic, of course. Only now it wasn't, and he had the answer. If she hadn't thrown the pitcher, he would have shattered it on the floor himself and tried to shove one of the broken pieces of glass into her throat while she stood there, as inert as an umbrella stand. He looked down into the spillage from the drawer, but there was only the change, a pen, a comb, and his watch. No wallet. More important, no Swiss Army knife. She came back a little at a time, and the anger at least was gone. She looked down at him sadly. I think I better go now. I don't think I better be around you for a while. I don't think it's... wise. Go? Where? It doesn't matter. A place I know. If I stay here, I'll do something unwise. I need to think. Goodbye, Paul. She strode across the room. Will you be back to give me my medication? He asked, alarmed. She grasped the doorknob and pulled the door shut without answering. For the first time, he heard the rattle of a key. He heard her footsteps going off down the hall. He winced as she cried out angrily, words he couldn't understand. And something else fell and shattered. A door slammed. An engine cranked over and then started up. The low, crunching squeal of tires turned on packed snow. Now the motor sound began to go away. It dwindled to a snore and then to a drone and was finally gone. He was alone. Alone in Annie Wilkes' house, locked in this room, locked in this bed. The distance between here and Denver was like, well, the distance between the Boston Zoo and Africa. He lay in bed looking at the ceiling, his throat dry and his heart beating fast. After a while, the parlor clock chimed noon and the tide began to go out. 51 hours. He knew just how long because of the pen, the flare fine liner he had been carrying in his pocket at the time of the crash. He'd been able to reach down and snag it. Every time the clock chimed, he made a mark on his arm. 4 vertical marks and then a diagonal slash to seal the quintet. When she came back, there were 10 groups of 5 and 1 extra. The little groups, neat at first, grew increasingly jagged as his hands began to tremble. He didn't believe he had missed a single hour. He had dozed, but never really slept. The chiming of the clock woke him each time the hour came around. After a while, he began to feel hunger and thirst, even through the pain. It became something like a horse race. At first, King of Pain was far in the lead, and I got the hungries with some 12 furlongs back. Pretty Thirsty was nearly lost in the dust. Then around sunup on the day after she had left, I got the hungries actually gave King of Pain a brief run for his money. He had spent much of the night alternately dozing and waking in a cold sweat, sure that he was dying. After a while, he began to hope he was dying. Anything to be out of it. He'd never had any idea how bad the hurting could get. The pilings grew and grew. He could see the barnacles which encrusted them, could see pale, drowned things lying limply in the clefts of the wood. They were the lucky things. For them, the hurting was over. Around 3, he had lapsed into a bout of useless screaming. By noon of the second day, hour 24, he realized that as bad as the pain in his legs and pelvis was, something else was also making him hurt. It was withdrawal. Call this horse junkie's revenge if you wanted. He needed the capsules in more ways than one. He thought of trying to get out of the bed, but the thought of the thump and the drop and the accompanying escalation of pain constantly deterred him. He could imagine all too well, so vivid, how it would feel. He might have tried anyway, but she had locked the door. What could he do besides crawl across to it, snail-like, and lie there? In desperation, he pushed back the blankets with his hands for the first time, hoping against hope that it wasn't as bad as the shapes the blankets made seemed to suggest it was. It wasn't as bad. It was worse. He stared with horror at what he had become below the knees. In his mind, he heard the voice of Ronald Reagan in King's Row shrieking, "Where's the rest of me?" The rest of him was here, and he might get out of this. The prospects for doing so seemed ever more remote, but he supposed it was technically possible. But he might well never walk again, and surely not until each of his legs had been rebroken, perhaps in several places, and pinned with steel, and mercilessly overhauled, and subjected to a 100 shriekingly painful indignities. She had splinted them. Of course he had known that, felt the rigid, ungiving shapes. But until now he had not known what she had done it with. The lower parts of both legs were circled with slim steel rods that looked like the hacksawed remains of aluminum crutches. The rods had been strenuously taped so that from the knees down he looked a bit like Imhotep when he had been discovered in his tomb. The legs themselves meandered strangely up to his knees, turning outward here, jagging inward there. His left knee, a throbbing focus of pain, no longer seemed to exist at all. There was a calf and a thigh, and then a sickening bunch in the middle that looked like a salt dome. His upper legs were badly swollen and seemed to have bowed slightly outwards. His thighs, crotch, even his penis were all still mottled with fading bruises. He had thought his lower legs might be shattered. That was not so, as it turned out. They had been pulverized. Moaning, crying, he pulled the blankets back up. No rolling out of bed. Better to lie here, die here. Better to accept this level of pain, terrific as it was, until all pain was gone. Around 4 o'clock of the second day, Pretty Thirsty made its move. He had been aware of dryness in his mouth and throat for a long time, but now it began to seem more urgent. His tongue felt thick, too large. Swallowing hurt. He began to think of the pitcher of water she had dashed away. He dozed, woke, dozed. Day passed away. Night fell. He had to urinate. He laid the top sheet over his penis, hoping to create a crude filter, and urinated through it into his cupped and shaking hands. He tried to think of it as recycling, and drank what he had managed to hold, and then licked his wet palms. Here was something else he reckoned he would not tell people about, if he lived long enough to tell them anything. He began to believe she was dead. She was deeply unstable, and unstable people frequently took their own lives. He saw her, so vivid, pulling over to the side of the road in Old Bessie, taking a .44 from under the seat, putting it in her mouth, and shooting herself. "With misery dead, I don't want to live. Goodbye, cruel world," Annie cried through a rain of tears, and pulled the trigger. He cackled, then moaned, then screamed. The wind screamed with him, but took no other notice. Or an accident. Was that possible? Oh, yes, sir. He saw her driving grimly, going too fast, and then, he doesn't get it from my side of the family, going blank and driving right off the side of the road, down and down and down, hitting once and bursting into a fireball, dying without even knowing it. If she was dead, he would die in here, a rat in a dry trap. He kept thinking unconsciousness would come and relieve him, but unconsciousness declined. Instead, hour 30 came, and hour 40. Now King of Pain and Pretty Thirsty merged into one single horse. I Got the Hungries had been left in the dust long since, and he began to feel like nothing more than a slice of living tissue on a microscope slide, or a worm on a hook. Something, anyway, twisting endlessly, and waiting only to die. When she came in, he thought at first she must be a dream, but then reality, or mere brute survival, took over, and he began to moan and beg and plead, all of it broken, all of it coming from a deepening well of unreality. The one thing he saw clearly was that she was wearing a dark blue dress and a sprigged hat. It was exactly the sort of outfit he had imagined her wearing on the stand in Denver. Her color was high, and her eyes sparkled with life and vivacity. She was as close to pretty as Annie Wilkes ever could be. And when he tried to remember that scene later, the only clear images he could fix upon were her flushed cheeks and the sprigged hat. From some final stronghold of sanity and evaluative clarity, the rational Paul Sheldon had thought, "She looks like a widow who just got fucked after a 10-year dry spell." In her hand she held a glass of water, a tall glass of water. "Take this," she said, and put a hand still cool from the out-of-doors on the back of his neck so he could sit up enough to drink without choking. He took 3 fast mouthfuls, the pores on the arid plain of his tongue widening and clamoring at the shock of the water, some of it spilling down his chin and onto the T-shirt he wore, and then she drew it away from him. He mewled for it, holding his shaking hands out. "No," she said. "No, Paul. A little at a time or you'll vomit." After a bit, she gave it back to him and allowed 2 more swallows.
"This stuff,"
he said, coughing. He sucked at his lips and ran his tongue over them and then sucked his tongue. He could vaguely remember drinking his own piss, how hot it had been, how salty.
"The capsules
pain. Please, Annie, please, for God's sake, help me. The pain is so bad.
I know it is, but you must listen to me, she said, looking at him with that stern yet maternal expression. I had to get away and think. I've thought deeply, and I hope I've thought well. I was not entirely sure. My thoughts are often muddy. I know that. I accept that. It's why I couldn't remember where I was all those times they kept asking me about. So I prayed. There is a God, you know, and he answers prayers. He always does. So I prayed. I said, Dear God, Paul Sheldon may be dead when I get back. But God said, He will not be. I have spared him, so you may shew him the way he must go. She said show as shew, but Paul was barely hearing her anyway. His eyes were fixed on the glass of water. She gave him another 3 swallows. He slurped like a horse, burped, then cried out as shudder cramps coursed through him. During all of this, she looked at him benignly. I will give you your medication and relieve your pain, she said. But first you have a job to do. I'll be right back. She got up and headed for the door.
No!
He screamed. She took no notice at all. He lay in bed, cocooned in pain, trying not to moan, and moaning anyway. At first he thought he had lapsed into delirium. What he was seeing was too bizarre to be sane. When Annie returned, she was pushing a charcoal grill in front of her.
Annie, I'm in terrible pain.
Tears coursed down his cheeks. I know, my dear. She kissed his cheek, the touch of her lips as gentle as the fall of a feather. Soon. She left, and he looked stupidly at the charcoal grill, something meant for an outdoor summer patio which now stood in his room, calling up relentless images of idols and sacrifices. And sacrifice was what she had in mind, of course. When she came back, she was carrying the manuscript of Fast Cars, the only existing result of his 2 years' work, in one hand. In the other, she had a box of diamond blue-tip wooden matches. He said, crying and shaking. One thought worked at him, burned in him like acid. For less than $100 he could have had the manuscript photocopied in Boulder. People, Bryce, both of his ex-wives, hell, even his mother, had always told him he was crazy not to make at least one copy of his work and put it aside. After all, the Boulderado could catch on fire, or the New York townhouse. There might be a tornado or a flood or some other natural disaster. He had constantly refused for no rational reason. It was just that making copies seemed a jinx thing to do. Well, here was the jinx and the natural disaster all rolled up in one. Here was Hurricane Annie. In her innocence, it had apparently never even crossed her mind that there might be another copy of Fast Cars someplace. And if he had just listened, if he had just invested the life, he replied. To him. The manuscript, clean white hammer mill bond, with a title page topmost, lay on her lap. Her face was clear and calm. No, he said, turning his burning face away from her. Yes, it's filthy. That aside, it's also no good.
You wouldn't know good if it walked up and bit your nose off,
he yelled, not caring. She laughed gently. Her temper had apparently gone on vacation. But Paul thought, knowing Annie Wilkes, it could arrive back unexpectedly at any moment, bags in hand. Couldn't stand to stay away. How you doing?
First of all, she said, good would not bite my nose off. Evil might, but not good. Second of all, I do know good when I see it. You are good, Paul. All you need is a little help. Now take the matches.
He shook his head stiffly back and forth.
No. Yes. No.
Yes.
No, God damn it! Use all the profanity you want. I've heard it all before. I won't do it.
He He closed his eyes. When he opened them, she was holding out a cardboard square with the word Novro printed across the top in bright blue letters. Sample, the red letters just below the trade name, read. Not to be dispensed without physician's prescription. Below the warning were four capsules in blister packs. He grabbed. She pulled the cardboard out of his reach. "When you burn it," she said. "Then I'll give you the capsules. All four of these, I think. And the pain will go away. You'll begin to feel serene again. And when you've got a hold of yourself, I'll change your bedding. I see you've wet it. It must be uncomfortable. And I'll also change you. By then, I can give you some buttered toast. But until you burn it, Paul, I can do nothing. I'm sorry." His tongue wanted to say, "Yes. Yes, okay." And so he bit it. He rolled away from her again. Away from the enticing, maddening cardboard square. The white capsules in her lozenge-shaped transparent blisters. "You're the devil," he said. Again, he expected rage and got the indulgent laugh, with its undertones of knowing sadness. "Oh, yes. Yes! That's what a child thinks when Mummy comes into the kitchen and sees him playing with a cleaning fluid from under the sink. He doesn't say it that way, of course, because he doesn't have your education. He just says, 'Mommy, you're mean.'" Her hand brushed his hair away from his hot brow. The fingers trailed down his cheek, across the side of his neck, and then squeezed his shoulder briefly, with compassion, before drawing away. The mother feels badly when her child says she's mean, or if he cries for what's been taken away as you're crying now. But she knows she's right, and so she does her duty, as I am doing mine. Three quick, dull thumps as Annie dropped her knuckles on the manuscript. 190,000 words and five lives that a well and pain-free Paul Sheldon had cared deeply about. 190,000 words and five lives that he was finding more dispensable as each moment passed. The pills. The pills. He had to have the goddamn pills. The lies were shadows. The pills were not. They were real. Paul.
"No!"
he sobbed. The faint rattle of the capsules in their blisters. Silence. Then the woody shuffle of the matches in their box. "Paul."
"No!"
"I'm waiting, Paul." "Why in Christ's name are you doing this asshole Horatio at the Bridge Act? And who in Christ's name are you trying to impress? You think this is a movie or a TV show and you're getting graded by some audience on your bravery? You can do what she wants or you can hold out. If you hold out, you'll die. And then she'll burn the manuscript anyway. So what are you going to do? Lie here and suffer for a book that would sell half as many copies as the least successful misery book you ever wrote? And which Peter Prescott would shit upon in his finest genteel disparaging manner when he reviewed it for that great literary oracle, Newsweek. Come on, come on. Wise up. Even Galileo recanted when he saw they really meant to go through. Paul, I'm waiting. Wait all day. Although I rather suspect that you may go into a coma before too long. I believe you're in a near comatose state now, and I have a lot of..." Her voice droned away. "Yes. Give me this. Give me a blowtorch. Give me a baby Huey and a load of napalm. I'll drop a tactical nuke on it if that's what you want, you fucking beldame." So spoke the opportunist, the survivor. Yet another part, failing now, near comatose itself, went wailing off into the darkness. 190,000 words, five lives, 2 years' work. And what was the real bottom line? The truth. What you knew about the fucking truth. There was the creak of bedsprings as she stood up. "Well, you are a very stubborn little boy, I must say. And I can't sit by your bed all night as much as I'd like to. After all, I've been driving for nearly an hour, hurrying to get back here. I'll drop in a bit and see if you've changed."
"You burn it, then!"
he yelled at her. She turned and looked at him. "No," she said. I cannot do that, as much as I would like to, and spare you the agony you feel.
Why not?
Because, she said primly, you must do it of your own free will. He began to laugh then, and her face darkened for the first time since she had come back, and she left the room with a manuscript under her arm. When she came back an hour later, he took the matches. She laid the title page on the grill. He tried to light one of the blue tips and couldn't because it kept missing the rough strip or falling out of his hand. So Annie took the box and lit the match and put the lit match in his hand, and he touched it to the corner of the paper, and then let the match fall into the pot and watched, fascinated, as the flame tasted, then gulped. She had a barbecue fork with her this time, and when the page began to curl up, she poked it through the gaps in the grill.
This is going to take forever, he said. I can't...
No, we'll make quick work of it, she said. But you must burn a few of the single pages, Paul, as a symbol of your understanding. She now laid the first page of Fast Cars on the grill. Words he remembered writing some 24 months ago in the New York townhouse. I don't have no wheels, Tony Bonassaro said, walking up to the girl coming down the steps. And I am a slow learner, but I am a fast driver. Oh, it brought that day back like the right golden oldie on the radio. He remembered walking around the apartment from room to room, big with book, more than big, gravid, and here were the labor pains. He remembered finding one of Joan's bras under a sofa cushion earlier in the day, and she had been gone a full 3 months, showed you what kind of a job the cleaning service did. He remembered hearing New York traffic, and faintly the monotonous tolling of a church bell calling the faithful to Mass. He remembered sitting down. As always, the blessed relief of starting, a feeling that was like falling into a hole filled with bright light. As always, the glum knowledge that he would not write as well as he wanted to write. As always, the terror of not being able to finish, of accelerating into a blank wall. As always, the marvelous, joyful, nervy feeling of journey begun. He looked at Annie Wilkes and said, clearly but not loud, Annie, please don't make me do this. She held the matches immovably before him and said, You can do as you choose. So he burned his book. She made him burn the first page, the last page, and 9 pairs of pages from various points in the manuscript, because 9, she said, was a number of power, and 9 doubled was lucky. He saw that she had used a magic marker to black out the profanities, at least as far as she had read. Now, she said when the 9th pair was burned, you've been a good boy and a real sport, and I know this hurts you almost as badly as your legs do, and I won't draw it out any longer. She removed the grill and set the rest of the manuscript into the pot, crunching down the crispy black curls of the pages he had already burned. The room stank of matches and burned paper. Smells like the devil's cloakroom, he thought deliriously. And if there had been anything in the wrinkled walnut shell that had once been his stomach, he supposed he would have vomited it up. She lit another match and put it in his hand. Somehow he was able to lean over and drop the match into the pot. It didn't matter anymore. It didn't matter. She was nudging him. Wearily he opened his eyes. It went out. Scratched another match and put it in his hand. So he somehow managed to lean over again, awakening rusty bandsaws in his legs as he did. Touched the match to the corner of the pile of manuscript. This time the flame spread instead of shrinking and dying around the stick. He leaned back, eyes shut, listening to the crackling sound, feeling the full, baking heat.
Goodness! She cried, alarmed.
He opened his eyes and saw that charred bits of paper were wafting up from the barbecue on the heated air. Annie lumbered from the room. He heard water from the tub taps thud into the floor pail. He idly watched a dark piece of manuscript float across the room and land on one of the gauzy curtains. There was a brief spark. He had time to wonder if perhaps the room was going to catch on fire. It winked once and then went out, leaving a tiny hole like a cigarette burn. Ash shifted down on the bed. Some landed on his arms. He didn't really care one way or the other. Annie came back, eyes trying to dart everywhere at once, trying to trace the course of each carbonized page as it rose and seesawed. Flames flipped and flickered over the edge of the pot.
Goodness!
She said again, holding the bucket of water and looking around, trying to decide where to throw it or if it needed to be thrown at all. Her lips were trembling and wet with spit. As Paul watched, her tongue darted out and slicked them afresh.
Goodness! Goodness!
It seemed to be all she could say. Even caught in the squeezing vice of his pain, Paul felt an instant of intense pleasure. This was what Annie Wilkes looked like when she was frightened. It was a look he would come to love. Another page wafted up, this one still running with little tendrils of low blue fire, and that decided her. With another goodness, she carefully poured the bucket of water into the barbecue pot. There was a monstrous hissing and a plume of steam. The smell was wet and awful, charred and yet somehow creamy. When she left, he managed to get up on his elbow one final time. He looked into the barbecue pot and saw something that looked like a charred lump of log floating in a brackish pond. After a while, Annie Wilkes came back. Incredibly, she was humming. She sat him up and pushed capsules into his mouth. He swallowed them and lay back, thinking, "I'm going to kill her." "Eat," she said from far away, and he felt stinging pain. He opened his eyes and saw her sitting beside him. For the first time, he was actually on a level with her, facing her. He realized with bleary, distant surprise that for the first time in untold eons, he was sitting too. Actually sitting up. "Who gives a shit?" he thought, and let his eyes slip shut again. The tide was in. The pilings were covered. The tide had finally come in, and the next time it went out, it might go out forever. So he was going to ride the waves while there were waves left to ride. He could think about sitting up later.
"Eat,"
she said again, and this was followed by a recurrence of pain. It buzzed against the left side of his head, making him whine and try to pull away.
"Eat, Paul! You've got to come out of it enough to eat her!"
Zing! His earlobe. She was pinching it.
"Kay," he muttered. "Kay, don't yank it off, for God's sake!"
He forced his eyes open. Each lid felt as if it had a cement block dangling from it. Immediately the spoon was in his mouth, dumping hot soup down his throat. He swallowed to keep from drowning. Suddenly, out of nowhere, "The most amazing comeback this announcer has ever seen, ladies and gentlemen," "I Got the Hungries" came bursting into view. It was as if that first spoonful of soup had awakened his gut from a hypnotic trance. He took the rest as fast as she could spoon it into his mouth, seeming to grow more rather than less hungry as he slurped and swallowed. He had a vague memory of her wheeling out the sinister smoking barbecue and then wheeling in something which, in his drugged and fading state, he had thought might be a shopping cart. The idea had caused him to feel neither surprise nor wonder. He was visiting with Annie Wilkes, after all. Barbecues. Shopping carts. Maybe tomorrow a parking meter or a nuclear warhead. When you lived in the fun house, the laugh riot just never stopped. He had drifted off, but now he realized that the shopping cart had been a folded-up wheelchair. He was sitting in it, his splinted legs stuck stiffly out in front of him, his pelvic area feeling uncomfortably swollen and not very happy with the condition. "She put me in it while I was conked out," he thought. "Lifted me. Dead weight. Christ, she must be strong."
"Finished," she said. "I'm pleased to see how well you took that soup, Paul. I believe you're going to mend. We will not say good is new, alas, no. But if we don't have any more of these contretemps, I believe you'll mend just fine. Now I'm going to change your nasty old bed, and when that's done, I'm going to change the nasty old you. And then if you're not having too much pain and still feel hungry, I'm going to let you have some toast."
"Thank you, Annie," he said humbly, and thought, "Your throat. If I can, I'll give you a chance to lick your lips and say goodness. But only once, Annie. Only once. 4 hours later, he was back in bed, and he would have burned all his books for even a single novel. Sitting hadn't bothered him a bit while he was doing it. Not with enough shit in his bloodstream to have put half the Prussian army to sleep. But now it felt as if a swarm of bees had been loosed in the lower half of his body. He screamed very loudly. The food must have done something for him, because he could not remember being able to scream so loudly since he had emerged from the dark cloud. He sensed her standing just outside the bedroom door in the hallway for a long time before she actually came in. Immobile, turned off, unplugged, gazing blankly at no more than the doorknob, or perhaps the pattern of lines in her own hands. Here. She gave him his medication. 2 capsules this time. He swallowed them, holding her wrist to steady the glass. I bought you 2 presents in town, she said, getting up. Did you? He croaked. She pointed at the wheelchair, which brooded in the corner with its steel leg rest stuck stiffly out. I'll show you the other one tomorrow. Now get some sleep, Paul. But for a long time, no sleep came. He floated on the dope and thought about the situation he was in. It seemed a little easier now. It was easier to think about than the book which he had created and then uncreated. Things. Isolated things like pieces of cloth which may be pieced together to make a quilt. They were miles from the neighbors who Annie said didn't like her. What was the name? Boynton. No, Roydman. That was it, Roydman. And how far from the town? Not too far, surely. He was in a circle whose diameter might be as small as 50 or as large as 45. Annie Wilkes' house was in that circle, and the Roydmans and downtown Sidewinder, however pitifully small that might be. And my car, my Camaro, somewhere in that circle, too. Did the police find it? He thought not. He was a well-known person. If a car had been found with tags registered in his name, a little elementary checking would have shown he had been in Boulder and then dropped out of sight. The discovery of his wrecked and empty car would have prompted a search, stories on the news. She never watches the news on TV, never listens to the radio at all, unless she's got one with an earplug or phones. It was all a little like a dog in a Sherlock Holmes story. The one that didn't bark. His car hadn't been found because the cops hadn't come. If it had been found, they would have checked everyone in his hypothetical circle, wouldn't they? And just how many people could there be in such a circle, here close to the top of the western slope? Roydman's, Annie Wilkes, maybe 10 or 12 others? And just because it hadn't been found so far didn't mean it wouldn't be found. His vivid imagination, which he had from anyone on his mother's side, now took over. The cop was this in which his voice, a famous writer named Paul Sheldon. Seats on the dashboard, but no sign of him. Must have crawled out, maybe even have wandered away in a daze. That was a laugh, considering the state of his legs. But of course they would not know what injuries he might have sustained. They would only assume that if he was not here, he must have been strong enough to get at least a little way. The course of their deductions was not apt to lead to such an unlikely possibility as kidnapping, at least not at first. Probably never. Do you remember seeing anyone on the road the day of the storm? Tall man, 42 years old, sandy hair. Probably wearing blue jeans and a check flannel shirt and a parka. Might have looked sort of bunged up. Hell, might not even have known who he was. Annie would give the cop coffee in the kitchen. Annie would be mindful that all the doors between there and the spare bedroom should be closed, in case he should groan. "Why, no, officer, I didn't see a soul. In fact, I came back from town just as quick as I could when Tony Roberts told me that bad old storm wasn't turning south after all." The cop setting down the coffee cup and getting up. "Well, if you should see anyone fitting the description, ma'am, I hope you'll get in touch with us just as fast as you can. He's quite a famous person, been in People magazine, some other ones, too." "I certainly will, officer." And away he would go. Maybe something like that had already happened, and he just didn't know about it. Maybe his imaginary cop's actual counterpart or counterparts had visited Annie while he was doped out. God knew he spent enough time doped out. More thought convinced him it was unlikely. He wasn't Joe Blow from Kokomo, just some transient blowing through. He had been in People, first bestseller, and Us, first divorce. There had been a question about him one Sunday in Walter Scott's personality parade. There would have been rechecks, maybe by phone, maybe by the cops themselves. When a celebrity, even a quasi-celebrity like a writer, disappeared, the heat came on. You're only guessing, man. Maybe guessing, maybe deducing. Either way, it was better than just lying here and doing nothing. What about guardrails? He tried to remember and couldn't. He could only remember reaching for his cigarettes and the amazing way the ground and sky had switched places, then darkness. But again, deduction or educated guesswork, if you wanted to be snotty, made it easier to believe there had been none. Smashed guardrails and snapped guy wires would have alerted road crews. So what exactly had happened? He had lost control at a place where there wasn't much of a drop, that was what. Just enough grade to allow the car to flip over in space. If the drop had been steeper, there would have been guardrails. If the drop had been steeper, Annie Wilkes would have found it difficult or impossible to get him, let alone drag him back to the road by herself. So where was his car? Buried in the snow, of course. Paul put his arm over his eyes and saw a town plow coming up the road where he had crashed only 2 hours earlier. The plow was a dim orange blob in the driving snow near the end of this day. The man driving is bundled to the eyes. On his head, he wears an old-fashioned trainman's cap of blue and white pillow tick. To his right, at the bottom of a shallow slope, which will not far from here deepen into a more typical upcountry gorge, lies Paul Sheldon's Camaro, with a faded blue Heart for President sticker on the rear bumper just about the brightest thing down there. The guy driving the plow doesn't see the car. Bumper sticker is too faded to catch his eye. The wing plows block most of his side vision, and besides, it's almost dark and he's beat. He just wants to finish this last run so he can turn the plow over to his relief and get a hot cup of Joe. He sweeps past. The plow spuming cloudy snow into the gully. The Camaro, already drifted to the windows, is now buried to the roof line. Later, in the deepest part of a stormy twilight, when even the things directly in front of you look unreal, the second shift man drives by, headed in the opposite direction, and entombs it. Paul opened his eyes and looked at the plaster ceiling. There was a fine series of hairline cracks up there that seemed to make a trio of interlocked W's. He had become very familiar with them over the endless run of days he had lain here since coming out of the cloud, and now he traced them again, idly thinking of W words, such as wicked and wretched and witch-like and wriggling. Yes. Could have been that way. Could have been. Had she thought of what might happen when his car was found? She might have. She was nuts, but being nuts didn't make her stupid. Yet it had never crossed her mind that he might have a duplicate of fast cars. Yeah, she was right. That bitch was right. I didn't. The images of the blackened pages floated up. The flames, the sounds, the smell of the uncreation. He gritted his teeth against the images and tried to shut his mind away from them. Vivid was not always good. No, you didn't. But 9 out of 10 writers would have. At least they would if they were getting paid as much as you have been for even the non-misery books. She never even thought of it. She's not a writer. Neither is she stupid, as I think we've both agreed. I think that she is filled with herself. She does not just have a large ego, but one which is positively grandiose. Burning it seemed to her the proper thing to do, and the idea that her concept of the proper thing to do might be short-circuited by something so piddling as a bank Xerox machine and a couple of rolls of quarters. That blip just never crossed her screen, my friend. His other deductions might be like houses built on quicksand, but this view of Annie Wilkes seemed to him as solid as the Rock of Gibraltar. Because of his researches for Misery, he had rather more than a layman's understanding of neurosis and psychosis. And he knew that although a borderline psychotic might have alternating periods of deep depression and almost aggressive cheerfulness and hilarity, The puffed and infected ego underlay all, positive that all eyes were upon him or her, positive that he or she was starring in a great drama. The outcome was a thing for which untold millions waited with held breath. Such an ego simply forbade certain lines of thought. These lines were predictable because they all stretched in the same direction, from the unstable person to objects, situations, or other persons outside of the subject's field of control, or fantasy. To the neurotic, there might be some difference, but to the psychotic, they were one and the same. Annie Wilkes had wanted fast cars destroyed, and so to her there had been only one copy. Maybe I could have saved the damn thing by telling her there were more. She would have seen destroying the manuscript was futile. His breathing, which had been slowing towards sleep, suddenly caught in his throat and his eyes widened. Yes, she would have seen it was futile. She would have been forced to acknowledge one of those lines leading to a place beyond her control. The ego would be hurt, squealing.
I have such a temper.
If she had been clearly faced with the fact that she couldn't destroy his dirty book, might she not have decided to destroy the creator of the dirty book instead? After all, there was no copy of Paul Sheldon. His heart was beating fast. In the other room, the clock began to bong, and overhead he heard her thumping footfalls across the ceiling. The faint sound of her urinating, the toilet flushing, the heavy pad of her feet as she went back to bed, the creak of the spring.
You won't make me mad again, will you?
His mind suddenly tried to break into a gallop, an overbred trotter trying to break stride. What, if anything, did all this dime store psychoanalysis mean in terms of his car? About when it was found? What did it mean to him?
Wait a minute, he whispered in the dark. Wait a minute, wait a minute. Just hold the phone. Slow down.
He put his arm across his eyes again and again conjured up the state trooper with the dark sunglasses and the overlong sideburns. We found an overturned car halfway down Humbuggy Mountain, the state trooper was saying, and blah-de-blah-de-blah. Only this time Annie doesn't invite him to stay for coffee. This time she isn't going to feel safe until he's out of her house and far down the road. Even in the kitchen, even with two closed doors between them and the guest room, even with a guest doped to his ears, the trooper might hear a groan. If his car was found, Annie Wilkes would know she was in trouble, wouldn't she?
Yes,
Paul whispered. His legs were beginning to hurt again, but in the dawning horror of this recognition, he barely noticed. She would be in trouble not because she had taken him to her house, especially if it was closer than Sidewinder, and so Paul believed it to be. For that, they would probably give her a medal and a lifetime membership in the Misery Chastain fan club. To Paul's endless chagrin, there actually was such a thing. The problem was she had taken him to her house and installed him in the guest room and told no one. No phone call to the local ambulance service. This is Annie up on the Humbuggy Mountain Road, and I've got a fellow here who looks a bit like King Kong used him for a trampoline. The problem was, she had filled him full of dope to which he was certainly not supposed to have access. Not if he was even half as hooked as he thought he was. The problem was, she had followed the dope with a weird sort of treatment, sticking IV needles in his arms, splinting his legs with sawed-off pieces of aluminum crutches. The problem was, Annie Wilkes had been on the stand up there in Denver. And not as a supporting witness either, Paul thought. I'd bet the house and a lot on that. So she watches the cop go down the road in his spandy-clean cruiser. Spandy-clean except for the caked chunks of snow and salt nestled in the wheel wells and under the bumpers, that is. And she feels safe again. But not too safe. Because now she is like an animal with its wind up. Way, way up. The cops will look and look and look. Because he is not just good old Joe Blow from Kokomo. He is Paul Sheldon, the literary Zeus from whose brow sprang Misery Chastain, darling of the dump bins and sweetheart of the supermarkets. Maybe when they don't find him, they'll stop looking, or at least look someplace else. But maybe one of the roidmen saw her going by that night, and saw something funny in the back of old Bessie. Something wrapped in a quilt. Something vaguely manlike. Even if they hadn't seen such a thing, she wouldn't put it past the roidmans to make up a story to get her in trouble. They didn't like her. The The cops might come back, and next time her house guest might not be so quiet. He remembered her eyes darting around aimlessly when the fire in the barbecue pot was on the verge of getting out of control. He could see her tongue slicking her lips. He could see her walking back and forth, hands clenching and unclenching, peeking every now and then into the guest room where he lay lost in his cloud. Every now and then she would utter, "Goodness!" to the empty rooms. She had stolen a rare bird with beautiful feathers, a rare bird which came from Africa. And what would they do if they found out? Why, put her up on the stand again, of course. Put her up on the stand again in Denver. And this time she might not walk free. He took his arm away from his eyes. He looked at the interlocking W swaying drunkenly across the ceiling. He didn't need his elbow over his eyes to see the rest. She might hang on to him for a day or a week. It might take a follow-up phone call or visit to make her decide to get rid of her rara avis. But in the end, she would do it, just as wild dogs begin to bury their illicit kills after they've been hunted a while. She would give him 5 pills instead of 2, or perhaps smother him with a pillow. Perhaps she would simply shoot him. Surely there was a rifle around somewhere. Almost everyone living in the high country had one. And that would take care of the problem. No, not the gun. Too messy. Might leave evidence. None of that had happened yet because no one had found the car. They might be looking for him in New York or L.A., but no one was looking for him in Sidewinder, Colorado. But in the spring... The W's straggled across the ceiling. Washed. Wiped. Wasted. The throbbing in his legs was more insistent. The next time the clock bonged, she would come. But he was almost afraid she would read his thoughts on his face, like the bare premise of a story too gruesome to write. His eyes drifted left. There was a calendar on the wall. It showed a boy riding a sled down a hill. It was February, according to the calendar. But if his calculations were right, it was already early March. Annie Wilkes had just forgotten to turn the page. How long before the melting snows revealed his Camaro with its New York plates and its registration in the glove compartment, proclaiming the owner to be Paul Sheldon? How long before that trooper called on her, or until she read it in the paper? How long until the spring melt? 6 weeks? 5? That could be the length of my life, Paul thought, and began shuddering. By then his legs were fully awake, and it was not until she had come in and given him another dose of medicine that he was able to fall asleep. The next evening she brought him the Royal. It was an office model from an era when such things as electric typewriters, color TVs, and touch-tone telephones were only science fiction. It was as black and as proper as a pair of high-buttoned shoes. Glass panels were set into the sides, revealing the machine's levers, springs, ratchets, and rods. A steel return lever, dull with disuse, jutted to one side like a hitchhiker's thumb. The roller was dusty, its hard rubber scarred and pitted. The letters Royal ran across the front of the machine in a semicircle. Grunting, she set it down on the foot of the bed between his legs, after holding it up for his inspection for a moment. He stared at it. Was it grinning? Christ, it looked like it was. Anyway, it already looked like trouble. The ribbon was a faded two-tone red over black. He had forgotten there were such ribbons. The sight of this one called up no pleasant nostalgia. Well, she was smiling eagerly. What do you think? It's nice, he said at once. A real antique. Her smile clouded. I didn't buy it for an antique. I bought it for second hand. Good second hand. He responded with immediate glibness. Hey, there ain't no such thing as an antique typewriter. Not when you come right down to it. A good typewriter lasts damn near forever. These old office babies are tanks. If he could have reached it, he would have patted it. If he could have reached it, he would have kissed it. Her smile returned. His heartbeat slowed a little. I got it at Used News. Isn't that a silly name for a store? But Nancy Dartmonger, the lady who runs it, is a silly woman. Annie darkened a little, but he saw at once that she was not darkening at him. The survival instinct he was discovering might be only instinct itself, but it created some really amazing shortcuts to empathy. He found himself becoming more attuned to her moods, her cycles. He listened to her tick as if she were a wounded clock.
As well as silly, she's bad, Dartmonger. Her name ought to be Whoremonger. Divorced twice, and now she's living with a bartender. That's why, when you said it was an antique...
It looks fine, he said. She paused a long moment, and then said, as if confessing,
it has a missing N.
Does it?
Yes. See?
She tilted the typewriter up so he could peer at the banked semicircle of keys and see the missing striker like a missing molar in a mouthful of teeth, worn but otherwise complete.
I see.
She set it back down. The bed rocked a little. Paul guessed the typewriter must weigh as much as 50 pounds. It had come from a time when there were no alloys, no plastics. Also, no six-figure book advances. No movie tie-in editions. No USA Today. No Entertainment Tonight. No celebrities doing ads for credit cards or vodka. The Royal grinned at him, promising trouble.
She wanted $45, but gave me 5 off because of the missing N.
She offered him a crafty smile. No fool she, it said. He smiled back. The tide was in. That made both smiling and lying easy.
Gave it to you? You mean you didn't dick her?
Annie preened a little.
I told her N was an important letter, she allowed. Well, good for you. Damn!
Here was a new discovery. Sycophancy was easy once you got the hang of it. Her smile grew sly, inviting him to share a delicious secret.
I told her N was one of the letters in my favorite writer's name.
It's 2 of the letters in my favorite nurse's name. Her smile became a glow. Incredibly, a blush rose in her solid cheeks. That's what it would look like, he thought, if you built a furnace inside the mouth of one of those idols in the H.R. Rider Haggard stories. That is what it would look like at night.
You fooler, she simpered.
I'm not, he said. Not at all.
Well.
She looked off for a moment. Not blank, but just pleased. A little flustered, taking a moment to gather her thoughts. Paul could have taken some pleasure in the way this was going, if not for the weight of the typewriter, as solid as the woman and also damaged. It sat there, grinning with its missing tooth, promising trouble.
The wheelchair was much more expensive, she said. Ostomy supplies have gone right out of sight since I...
She broke off, frowned, cleared her throat. Then she looked back at him, smiling.
But it's time you began sitting up, and I don't begrudge the cost one tiny bit. And of course you can't type lying down, can you?
No.
I've got a board. I cut it to size. And paper. Weight.
She dashed from the room like a girl, leaving Paul and the typewriter to regard each other. His grin disappeared the moment her back was turned. The Royals never varied. He supposed later that he had pretty well known what all this was about, just as he supposed he had known what the typewriter would sound like, how it would clack through its grin like that old comic strip character, Ducky Daddles. She came back with a package of corrascible bond and shrink wrap, and a board about 3 feet wide by 4 feet long.
Look!
She put the board on the arms of the wheelchair that stood by his bed, like some solemn skeletal visitor. Already he could see the ghost of himself behind that board, pent in like a prisoner. She put the typewriter on the board facing the ghost, and put the package of corrascible bond, the paper he hated most in all the world because of the way the type blurred when the pages were shuffled together, beside it. She had now created a kind of cripple's study.
What do you think?
It looks good, he said, uttering the biggest lie of his life with perfect ease, and then asked the question to which he already knew the answer.
What will I write there, do you think? Oh, but Paul, she said, turning to him, her eyes dancing animatedly in her flushed face. I don't think. I know.
You're going to use this typewriter to write a new novel. Your best novel. Misery's Return. Misery's Return. He felt nothing at all. He supposed a man who had just cut his hand off in a power saw might feel the same species of nothing as he stood regarding his spouting wrist with dull surprise.
Yes!
Her face shone like a searchlight. Her powerful hands were clasped between her breasts.
It'll be a book just for me, Paul. My payment for nursing you back to health. The one and only copy of the newest misery book. I'll have something no one else in the world has, no matter how much they might want it. Think of it.
Annie, misery is dead. But already, incredibly, he was thinking, I could bring her back. The thought filled him with tired revulsion, but no real surprise. After all, a man who could drink from a floor bucket should be capable of a little directed writing.
No, she's not, Annie replied dreamily. Even when I was so mad at you, I knew she wasn't really dead. I knew you couldn't really kill her. Because you're good.
Am I? He said, and looked at the typewriter. It grinned at him. We're going to find out just how good you are, old buddy, it whispered.
Yes!
Annie, I don't know if I can sit in that wheelchair. Last time
it hurt, you bet it did. And it will hurt the next time, too. Maybe even a little more. But there will come a day, and it won't be long either, although it may seem longer to you than it really is, when it hurts a little less, and a little less, and a little less.
Annie, will you tell me one thing?
Of course, dear.
If I write this story for you...
Novel! A nice big one like all the others, maybe even bigger.
He closed his eyes for a moment, then opened them. Okay, if I write this novel for you, will you let me go when it's done? For a moment, unease slipped cloudily across her face. And then she was looking at him carefully, studiously. You speak as though I were keeping you prisoner, Paul. He said nothing, only looked at her.
I think that by the time you finish, you should be up to the strain of meeting people again,
she said.
Is that what you want to hear?
That's what I wanted to hear, yes.
Well, honestly, I knew writers were supposed to have big egos, but I guess I didn't understand that meant ingratitude, too.
He went on looking at her, and after a moment she looked away, impatient and a little flustered. At last he said, I'll need all the misery books if you've got them, because I don't have my concordance.
Of course I have them, she said.
Then,
what's a concordance?
It's a loose-leaf binder where I have all my misery stuff, he said. Characters and places mostly, but cross-indexed three or four different ways. Timelines, historical stuff. He saw she was barely listening. This was the second time she'd shown not the slightest interest in a trick of the trade that would have held a class of would-be writers spellbound. The reason, he thought, was simplicity itself. Annie Wilkes was the perfect audience. A woman who loves stories without having the slightest interest in the mechanics of making them. She was the embodiment of that Victorian archetype, constant reader. She did not want to hear about his concordance and indices, because to her, misery and the characters surrounding her were perfectly real. Indices meant nothing to her. If he had spoken of a village census in Little Dunthorpe, she might have showed some interest.
I'll make sure you get the books. They're a little dog-eared. But that's a sign a book has been well-read and well-loved, isn't it?
Yes, he said. No need to lie this time. Yes, it is.
I'm going to study up on bookbinding, she said dreamily. I'm going to bind Misery's Return myself. Except for my mother's Bible, it'll be the only real book I own.
That's good, he said, just to say something. He was feeling a little sick to his stomach.
I'll go out now so you can put on your thinking cap,
she said. This is exciting. Don't you think so? Yes, Annie. I sure do. I'll be in with some breast of chicken and mashed potatoes and peas for you in half an hour. Even a little jello, because you've been such a good boy. And I'll make sure you get your pain medication right on time. You can even have an extra pill in the night if you need it. I want to make sure you get your sleep, because you have to go back to work tomorrow. You'll mend faster when you're working, I bet. She went to the door, paused there for a moment, and then grotesquely blew him a kiss. The door closed behind her. He did not want to look at the typewriter and for a while resisted, but at last his eyes rolled helplessly toward it. It sat on the bureau, grinning. Looking at it was a little like looking at an instrument of torture, boot, rack, strappado, which is standing inactive, but only for the moment. I think that by the time you finish, you should be up to the strain of meeting people again. Oh, Annie, you were lying to both of us. I knew it, and you did, too. I saw it in your eyes. The limited vista now opening before him was extremely unpleasant. 6 weeks of life, which he would spend suffering with his broken bones and renewing his acquaintance with Misery Chastain, nay, Carmichael, followed by a hasty internment in the backyard. Or perhaps she would feed his remains to Misery the pig. That would have a certain justice, black and gruesome though it might be. Then don't do it. Make her mad. She's like a walking bottle of nitroglycerin as it is. Bounce her around a little. Make her explode. Better than lying here suffering. He tried looking up at the interlocked W's, but all too soon he was looking at the typewriter again. It stood atop the bureau, mute and thick and full of words he did not want to write, grinning with its one missing tooth. I don't think you believe that, old buddy. I think you want to stay alive, even if it does hurt. If it means bringing Misery back for an encore, you'll do it. You try, anyway. But first you're going to have to deal with me. And I don't think I like your face. Makes us even, Paul croaked. This time he tried looking out the window, where fresh snow was falling. Soon enough, however, he was looking at the typewriter again, with avid, repulsed fascination, not even aware of just when his gaze had shifted. Getting into the chair didn't hurt as much as he had feared, and that was good, because previous experience had shown him that he could hurt plenty afterwards. She set the tray of food down on the bureau, then rolled the wheelchair over to the bed. She helped him to sit up. There was a dull, thudding flare of pain in his pelvic area, but it subsided. And then she leaned over, the side of her neck pressing against his shoulder like the neck of a horse. For an instant he could feel the thump of her pulse, and his face twisted in revulsion. Then her right arm was firmly around his back, her left under his buttocks. "Try not to move from the knees while I do this," she said, and then simply slid him into the chair. She did it with the ease of a woman sliding a book into an empty slot in her bookcase. Yes, she was strong. Even in good shape, the outcome of a fight between him and Annie would have been in doubt. And as he was now, it would be like Wally Cox taking on Boom Boom Mancini. She put the board in front of him. "See how well it fits?" she said, and went to the bureau to get the food. "Annie." "Yes?" "I wonder if you could turn that typewriter around so it faces the wall." She frowned. "Why in the world do you want me to do that?" "Because I don't want it grinning at me all night." "Old superstition of mine," he said. "I always turn my typewriter to the wall before I start writing." He paused and added, "Every night while I am writing, as a matter of fact." "It's like step on a crack, break your mother's back," she said. "I never step on a crack if I can help it." She turned it around so it grinned at nothing but blank wall. "Better?" "Much." "You are such a silly," she said, and came over and began to feed him. He dreamed of Annie Wilkes in the court of some fabulous Arabian caliph, conjuring imps and genies from bottles, and then flying around the court on a magic carpet. When the carpet banked past him, her hair streamed out behind her, Her eyes were as bright and flinty as the eyes of a sea captain navigating among icebergs. He saw it was woven all in green and white. It made a Colorado license plate. Once upon a time, Annie was calling. Once upon a time it came to pass. This happened in the days when my grandfather's grandfather was a boy. This is the story of how a poor boy... I heard this from a man who... Once upon a time. Once upon a time. When he woke up, Annie was shaking him, and bright morning sun was slanting in the window. The snow had ended. Wake up, sleepyhead! Annie was almost trilling. I've got yogurt and a nice boiled egg for you, and then it will be time for you to begin. He looked at her eager face and felt a strange new emotion. Hope. He had dreamed that Annie Wilkes was Scheherazade, her solid body clad in diaphanous robes, her big feet stuffed into pink sequined slippers with curly toes, as she rode on her magic carpet and chanted the incantatory phrases which open the doors of the best stories. But of course it wasn't Annie that was Scheherazade. He was. And if what he wrote was good enough, if she could not bear to kill him until she discovered how it all came out, no matter how much or how loudly her animal instincts yelled for her to do it, that she must do it, might he not have a chance? He looked past her and saw she had turned the typewriter around before waking him. It grinned resplendently at him with its missing tooth, telling him it was all right to hope and noble to strive, but in the end it was doom alone which would count. She rolled him over to the window, so the sun fell on him for the first time in weeks, and it seemed to him he could feel his pasty white skin, dotted here and there with minor bedsores, murmur its pleasure and thanks. The window panes were edged on the inside with a tracery of frost, and when he held out his hand, he could feel a bubble of cold like a dome around the window. The feel of it was both refreshing and somehow nostalgic, like a note from an old friend. For the first time in weeks, it felt like years, he was able to look at a geography different from that of his room with its unchanging verities. Blue wallpaper, picture of the Arc de Triomphe, the long, long month of February symbolized by the boy sliding downhill on his sled. He thought that his mind would turn to that boy's face and stocking cap each time January became February, even if he lived to see that change of months another 50 times. He looked into this new world as eagerly as he had watched his first movie, Bambi, as a child. The horizon was near. Its longer views of the world were inevitably cut off by up-tilted plates of bedrock. The sky was a perfect early morning blue, innocent of clouds. A carpet of green forest climbed the flank of the nearest mountain. There were perhaps 70 acres of open ground between the house and the edge of the forest. The snow cover over it was a perfect and blazing white. It was impossible to tell if the land beneath was tilled earth or open meadow. The view of this open square was interrupted only by one building, a neat red barn. When she spoke of her livestock, or when he saw her trudging grimly past his window, breaking her breath with the impervious prow of her face, he had imagined a ramshackle outbuilding like an illustration from a child's book of ghost stories. Roof tree bowed and sagging from years of snow weight, windows blank and dusty, some broken and blocked with pieces of cardboard, long double doors perhaps off their tracks and swaying outward. This neat and tidy structure with its dark red paint and neat cream-colored trim looked like the 5-car garage of a well-to-do country squire masquerading as a barn. In front of it stood a Jeep Cherokee, maybe 5 years old, for her plow in a homemade wooden crate. Chops from them if she was dying of starvation. The driveway was neatly plowed, a testament to the fact that she did indeed use the blade, but he could not see the road. The house cut off the view. I see you're admiring my barn, Paul. He looked around, startled. The quick and uncalculated movement awoke his pain from its doze. It snarled dully in what remained of his shins, and in the bunched salt dome that had replaced his left knee. It turned over, imprisoned in its cave of bones, and then fell lightly asleep again. She had food on a tray. Soft food, invalid food, but his stomach growled at the sight of it. As she crossed to him, He saw that she was wearing white shoes with crepe soles. "Yes," he said. "It's very handsome." She put the board on the arms of the wheelchair and then put the tray on the board. She pulled a chair over beside him and sat down, watching him as he began to eat.
"Fiddledy-foof. Handsome is as handsome does, my mother always said. I keep it nice because if I didn't, the neighbors would yap. They're always looking for a way to get at me or start a rumor about me. So I keep everything nice. Keeping up appearances is very, very